From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, what you should know about the toxic chemicals in everyday products, from computers to cosmetics. We talk with investigative reporter Mark Shapiro, author of the new book Exposed. He'll tell us about a plastic additive that's in everything from IV tubes to shampoo bottles, shower curtains, and children's toys. It's also turning up in the blood of many Americans, according to a CDC study that found 148 toxic chemicals in blood tests of Americans of all ages. We'll also talk about why the European Union has more stringent regulations than the U.S., and what that means for our health and our economy. Also, book critic Maureen Carrigan reviews the new novella, Last Night at the Lobster, by Stuart Onan. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Many of the products that are integral parts of our lives, from computers to cosmetics, have toxic chemicals inside. In some cases, the presence of toxics in these products is perfectly legal in the U.S., but not in Europe, as a result of recent regulation by the European Union. Are we going to end up with the toxic products that the EU has rejected? That's one of many issues raised by Mark Shapiro in his new book, Exposed: The Toxic Chemistry of Everyday Products and What's at Stake for American Power. Shapiro is the editorial director of the Center for Investigative Reporting in Berkeley. A lot of toxic chemicals are showing up in the bodies of Americans of all ages, according to a 2005 study by the Centers for Disease Control, the CDC. I asked Shapiro to describe the study and its results.
Yes, well, what the CDC went out and did is they decided to determine how many of these chemicals are ending up in the blood of Americans. And so they tested for some 148 different chemicals, and they realized that basically 148 chemicals were ending up in Americans' blood. And this includes chemicals that are carcinogenic, that are mutagenic, that cause problems with the endocrine system, that cause problems with the reproductive system, and a whole litany of synthetic chemicals were surfacing in the blood of Americans. And the question is, where are these chemicals coming from? And so part of my book, I look at the question of where some of these chemicals are coming from, and it seems clear that they're coming from many of the consumer products that we use on a routine basis.
And before we get to some of these products, what are some of the theories about what medical problems might be caused by these toxics that are showing up in our blood?
Well, if you look at epidemiological surveys of the last number of years, there's been spikes in the incidences of breast cancer. There's been spikes in the incidences of reproductive problems among young women. There have been declining sperm counts among men, rising incidences of endocrine troubles, and even incidences of sort of mutagenic effects in young children as a result of chemicals being passed through the uterus. And so there's been a kind of a litany of epidemiological data suggesting that the chemicals that we are encountering in our daily lives are resurfacing 5, 10, 15, 20 years later and contributing to these public health problems.
Let's talk about a toxic that I'd never heard of before, but I've certainly used products that it's in, and I think everybody else will be able to say the same. I don't even know how to pronounce this. It's P-T-H-A-L-A-T-E-S. Why don't you pronounce it for us? Tell us what it is and what it's in.
Yeah, this is an incredible substance called phthalates. Phthalates are really pretty much omnipresent in many, many different products across the spectrum. They're often used in bottles to make bottles. It's a plastic additive. So you use it to make plastic soft. They're used extensively, for example, in IV tubes, believe it or not. In actual IV tubes use phthalates to make them sort of pliable. They're used in bottles, shampoo bottles, water bottles use phthalates. And critically, phthalates are used in children's toys to make toys nice and soft and pliable. All those kind of rubber duckies that you might remember as a kid or people with children are still playing around with. The little toy giraffes and toy trolls, things that are soft and pliable, often have phthalates in them.
Can we add dashboards to the list?
We can add dashboards. And what's funny is that phthalates kind of slowly degrade. And the dashboard in your car, you might notice that after a couple of years, it gets a little more brittle. It's not quite as soft and pliable as it was when you bought it. And that's because the phthalates in the dashboard basically enter into the air and come out of the plastic into the air, and the plastic becomes harder as a result. So basically, you're breathing them in as time goes on over long periods of time.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because I always think of plastics as like inert substances, like they are what they are and nothing's going to come off of them. But apparently these phthalates in certain plastics, we end up breathing in particles of it?
Yeah. I mean, we breathe them in all the time. They're in shower curtains, the plastic shower curtains and stuff. Phthalates are kind of all around us. And if we think that that plastic is an inert substance, you know, we really are misunderstanding what plastics are, which is a combination of different chemical elements to create this phenomenal stuff that has kind of transformed what we experience in the marketplace over the last 40 years. I mean, it's the plastic, the era of plastic that we're living in now. And a lot of that is made possible through phthalates. But there's a problem. And the problem is that the scientists have been studying extensively. Phthalates are hugely studied. I mean, I went through, for the book, I went through dozens of different studies, and there are piles and piles of studies on phthalates. And what they're actually finding out is that phthalates can have a very strong effect on the endocrine system. So young children who are exposed to phthalates very early, between the ages of like 1 and 3 years old, phthalates can have a very potent effect on the development of testosterone, which I don't have to tell you is not really something you want to play around with at a young age. And what they've found is that when phthalates are passed through the mother, through the mother's womb into a child, and children are born with existing exposure to phthalates, and then in the process of sucking on all those neat little toys, playing with them, breathing them as they degrade, they're finding children in America with kind of rising rates of phthalates in their blood.
Now, a lot of your book is about how the United States, compared to the European Union, is regulating toxic substances in everyday products. So has the U.S. done anything about phthalates in terms of regulation?
Well, the answer to that is no. And what's extraordinary when I began looking at this was I realized there's an enormous amount of research being done by American scientists. The Environmental Protection Agency supports a lot of very top-flight scientific research into phthalates and many other chemicals that that I talk about in the book. And what's been interesting to see is that these scientists come out with this incredible research, and there's been nobody in the federal government willing to act on their findings. But these scientists increasingly are finding a very willing, receptive audience, not in Washington, but in Brussels. And Brussels, of course, is the capital of the European Union. And in the European Union, these American scientists, many of which are supported by the EPA, end up submitting their evidence. They've done testimony in the European Parliament, and the European Union has taken very, very strong action when it comes to phthalates. So you have a situation where the EU, starting back in 1999, basically passed a law that said that because of the dangers to children from exposure to phthalates, they banned phthalates in children's toys. European industry has found a very effective substitute means, far less toxic substitutes to be used in children's toys. And I assure you, if you've been to Europe, and children have plenty of good times with their fun little pliable toys. It's not like they've been thrown back into the Stone Age for toys. There's plenty of little fun items in every European children's playgroup. So the Europeans have taken a very strong stand as a way of protecting their children from the exposure to phthalates, whereas here in the United States, there's been no action on the federal level. I would add that about a month ago, in the state of California finally, after analyzing the same data that the Europeans have analyzed over these many, many years, decided to ban phthalates. The governor of California, Schwarzenegger, signed a law that would ban phthalates from children's toys starting in January 2009.
Now, as you point out in your book, China manufactures about 85% of the world's toys. Are they manufacturing toys with phthalates?
Yes. I mean, this is one of the incredible things that I found in researching this book, is that China, of course, is a huge producer of goods across the spectrum in the consumer marketplace. China produces, as you said, 85% of the world's toys. So what do? Well, for the European market, they produce toys without phthalates. And then you look at the United States, and they are producing toys with phthalates for the United States. So sometimes in the very same industrial region, because often in China, single industries are concentrated in particular regions of the country, you have in a single industrial region toys being produced with phthalates for the United States and without phthalates for Europeans.
Is it cheaper to produce the toys with phthalates? Because it's not like Americans are demanding more phthalates in their children's toys.
No, I mean, not that I've noticed. No, it's just that the government hasn't demanded it. The government hasn't demanded it. Toys are not significantly higher whatsoever in Europe. In fact, some of the major multinational companies, for example, BASF and other big multinational companies in Europe that used to produce phthalates are now producing a phthalate substitute that works very well. And the toys have stayed the same. And the toy industry in Europe, and this is what I looked at, was interesting to see, did this have an economic impact on the toy industry? And no, it didn't. the toy industry is doing very fine in Europe. It's actually grown steadily, and the economic impact. I actually went and researched in this book. I went and tried to find an analyst here in the United States or in Europe who would tell me what the effect was of the phthalate ban in Europe on the toy industry. You know, I spent a lot of time trying to find out what is the economic impact of these kind of changes. And I couldn't find one analyst anywhere, either in Europe or the United States, who said that it even had a negligible impact on the financial status of the toy industry.
Is there any way of finding out whether products you have phthalates in them? I mean, do they have ingredients that say phthalates on them?
Well, usually not. I mean, there's really no law that requires that ingredients be listed. I think you can assume that if it does not say phthalate-free, there's a very good chance that phthalates are in the toys that you are using today. And I would just I'd point out, because it's kind of fascinating. I like following trails, and I like following information, and I've kind of approached this whole topic from a very hard-edged look. It's like, what is the economic impact? How do these products flow through the global economy? We know that China and other emerging economies are important producers in the whole global picture. And so I wanted to see how these laws that came out of either Europe or America sort of rippled their way through the global economy. And what was interesting is to see that, one, we talked about how China, it clearly is producing a huge amount of toys for the American market. And every month I've been following, there's an incredible database that the European customs officials have developed. And that database basically lists every product that is confiscated off the market in Europe because it violates one or another of these chemical safety restrictions. Every month that I've been following this for like 2 years now. Every month there's been some confiscations of little toys off of the shelves in European stores because of their violation of the phthalate ban. And it's incredible. You look at the data and it says something like, you know, for example, last July, the authorities in Lithuania confiscated a whole shipment of little toy giraffes and toy hippopotamus made out of plastic because they violated the phthalate ban. And the question is, where do those toys end up once they're confiscated in the European Union?
I see where you're heading.
Okay.
They come here. Is that what you're going to say?
Yes. I mean, this is the market.
You're saying we get the stuff that's too dangerous for Europe.
Exactly. Stuff that's too dangerous for Europe ends up being sent to the United States.
My guest is Mark Shapiro. His new book is called Exposed. We'll talk more about toxic chemicals in everyday products after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Mark Shapiro. He's the author of the book Exposed, The Toxic Chemistry of Everyday Products and What's at Stake for American Power. He's also the editorial director of the Center for Investigative Reporting in Berkeley. You're telling us that because of the different regulatory environments in the United States versus the European Union, there's a lot of chemicals that are considered unsafe in the European Union, and when products containing those chemicals are confiscated, some of them are going to get sold in the United States because they're not regulated against here. Give us another example of something that you think is getting dumped, so to speak, in the United States because you can't sell it in Europe.
Cosmetics. Let's start with cosmetics. Many people, of course, use cosmetics. Many women use cosmetics. Some men use cosmetics. It's a pretty popular item. And most Americans, I think, are really not really aware of what are in cosmetics. I mean, people think it's kind of some kind of natural flowers and things like that, but in fact, it's a lot of synthetic chemicals. So what happened in March of 2005 was the European Union passed a law which basically prohibited the use of three types of chemicals in cosmetics, and that is, one, carcinogenic chemicals, two, chemicals that cause mutations, genetic mutations, and three that caused damage to the reproductive system. So starting in March 2005, you had this incredible law that came out in the European Union. And I say incredible because the effect that it had on the American cosmetic industry was dramatic. Because never before has the American cosmetic industry been forced even to reveal the nature of the ingredients in the cosmetics that are sold to Americans. And so what happened was that several major American multinationals began looking at the ingredients in their cosmetics. And they began analyzing what are in their cosmetics. And they began removing the chemicals that cause reproductive harm, that cause cancer, and that cause mutations. And one after another, you know, I went to, during my reporting, I spent quite a bit of time in Brussels, and I went to the headquarters of a major American cosmetic manufacturer. And I talked to those people about what they were doing about this new law. And the interesting thing is, they said, well, of course, we're going through our ingredients, and we're going to take the ones out that cause cancer or mutations or reproductive damage. And they were just going through a systematic effort. They hired a couple of new toxicologists, they hired a couple of new lawyers, and they went through it. And then this was in 2005, about 3 or 4 months later, I came back to California, where I live, and there was a debate raging in the California state capitol in Sacramento. And it was about a bill that would require cosmetic companies to reveal to the state health authorities the chemicals that were cancer-causing, mutagenic, or reproductive toxins. And who was the strongest lobbyist against that measure in the legislature was representatives of the very same company who I just interviewed in Brussels and who told me they were taking those chemicals out.
So does this mean that Europeans are getting safer cosmetics than Americans are?
Yes, that is what it means. That is what it means.
Does the European Union have just a different philosophy about regulation than, say, the Environmental Protection Agency does or the Food and Drug Administration?
Yes. The European Union takes what they call a precautionary principle, which is basically they look at the accumulation of evidence. And when the accumulation of evidence begins to suggest harm, they believe in acting before harm is actually done. In the United States, we have a much higher threshold for action by the regulatory authorities. So basically, you have to have a complete, scientifically unquestioned accumulation of evidence. And even at that point, which many scientists say is extremely difficult to obtain, we saw some of this dynamic unfolding around the global warming question about the accumulation of scientific data, which the Europeans were ready to move much quicker on than those in the United States. So here in the United States, the regulatory agencies are, one, held to a very high standard of scientific proof of harm, which is a very difficult standard to meet. Number two, are forced to go through a cost-benefit analysis where the costs to industry are weighed against the benefits to society. And I think these two factors have made American regulatory authorities far slower to act against harm than those in Europe.
Let's get back to cosmetics. I think a lot of lipstick wearers were very alarmed recently to learn that there was a test conducted by the Campaign for Safe Cosmetics, and they released a study saying that more than half of 33 brand name lipsticks that they tested contained detectable levels of lead, and one-third of the tested lipsticks exceeded the FDA's limit for lead in candy, to which I can only say, what? There's lead in candy? I mean, forget even lipsticks for a minute. What is lead doing in candy? And what is it doing in lipsticks?
Well, I thought it tasted really good, actually.
Yeah, candy. yeah.
It's delicious. You just suck on it. It's really good. I'm not sure why it actually ends up in candy, to be totally honest. I think it may have some adhesive qualities that hold the sugar or the composition together. And I think with lipstick, it aids in the application somehow. And I think that this the phenomenon has been startling. And I think it tells the story of how inadequate the American regulatory authorities have been in watching over this process. And now suddenly we're finding out, and not because the regulatory authorities have found the lead. Let's make that clear. It wasn't the U.S. government. It was actually a group of NGOs. It was a group of environmental health non-governmental organizations that actually did their own tests and found the lead in the candy and in the lipsticks and then reported it to the press. and the word finally got to the U.S. government. So I think it tells you a lot about the inadequate efforts of the U.S. government to even monitor these substances.
And I should say, if you want to find out if your lipstick has lead in it, don't bother looking at the ingredients because it's not going to be listed even if it's in it, right?
No, certainly not.
So what does the FDA have to say about regulating cosmetics? Like, what does the FDA see as its role in regulating cosmetics and toiletries?
The FDA has a very limited role when it comes to regulating cosmetics. I mean, it was back in the 30s the FDA was created, and at that time the nascent, you know, cosmetic industry succeeded in exempting themselves from regulation by the Food and Drug Administration. So the Food and Drug Administration does not have authority to regulate the ingredients in cosmetics. I mean, I think most Americans presume that somebody somewhere has signed off on the safety of cosmetics, and in fact, that's not the case. Other than hair dyes, where the FDA does have some limited authority to oversee the kind of ingredients that are in hair dyes, but otherwise, and you know, all the mascaras and the creams and all the fun substances that you put in your eyes and your face and your skin, there's nobody out there that basically is saying that they're safe, and that's because the FDA doesn't have the power.
Mark Shapiro is the author of Exposed, The Toxic Chemistry of Everyday Products and What's at Stake for American Power. He's the editorial director of the Center for Investigative Reporting in Berkeley. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Abrams Image, publisher of Plato and a Platypus Walk into a Bar, Understanding Philosophy Through Jokes by Thomas Cathcart and Daniel Klein. From the dairy farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont at cabotcheese.coop. And from 20th Century Fox Home Entertainment, presenting The Namesake, a vibrant coming-of-age story starring Cal Penn, on DVD Tuesday. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, toxic chemicals inside computers and cell phones. We continue our conversation with Mark Shapiro. Also, Maureen Carrigan reviews Last Night at the Lobster, a new novella by Stuart Onan set in a Red Lobster restaurant the day before it's scheduled to close. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Mark Shapiro, author of the book Exposed, The Toxic Chemistry of Everyday Products and What's at Stake for American Power. In addition to discussing toxics in everything from computers to cosmetics, the book explains that the European Union has adopted much stricter controls on these toxics. Shapiro says that's likely to have an impact on the health of Americans and our economy. Let's look at another series of products that has toxics within them. And again, this is something that I've just never really thought about a lot. I guess I should have known better, but a lot of electronic products, including computers and cell phones, have toxics in them. Run through the list of some of these products that we should be thinking about when it comes to either using them or disposing of them.
The chemicals that are in electronics, because electronics are very sophisticated items, and I've came up with immense respect for the engineers who've devised all these innovative products, you know, the iPods and the DVD players and the video players. But to make these things work, you need small amounts of very toxic either chemicals or minerals to make the electrical connections work. And that includes things like cadmium and chromium and lead and mercury, and as well as flame retardants that are used on our computers and our printers and everything called PBDEs. And these substances, over time, once you throw them away in a dump, and they slowly begin to degrade, and all those connections unravel, and the covers begin to disintegrate and rust. And these small amounts of chemicals in these electronic devices begin to leach into the water supply and into the soil and into the air. And so the European Union began analyzing what cost this would have down the line, 10, 20 years down the line, as all these chemicals begin accumulating. And so what's happened is we've learned an enormous amount about the chemical composition of these electronics. And I would stress that basically it's not like you're going to get sick from holding on to an electronic device in one form or another, because in their current state, the state that you buy them in, it's all pretty well contained. But we're talking about the long-term disposal of these kind of products. And that's where the public health issues begin to raise their head. And the Europeans, looking at this kind of long-term effect of the disposal problem of these substances, decided to ban these six substances, which, as I mentioned, cadmium, chromium, lead, mercury, and two types of fire retardants that are considered to be carcinogenic. And in the process, you know, it's incredible, Terry, in the process of reporting this book, I sat in these meetings, because I live not far from Silicon Valley. I live in San Francisco. And I'd go down to these meetings where people from the high-tech industries would gather for these seminars. And they were these kind of panicked seminars, because these consultants would come in who were American engineers who had come to understand what it was the Europeans were doing. And they were delivering the news to their engineer colleagues about, hold on, you guys, you know, in several months, you guys are not going to be able to work anymore with lead and mercury and cadmium and chromium. And there was such unease and disorientation in the room, because for the first time you had this power, because nobody wants to lose the European market. This is a $500 billion a year market for the electronics industry. And so this move coming out of the European Union forced the engineers who are responsible for some of those great American high-tech inventions to really rethink the means by which they constructed those inventions.
So have engineers come up with alternatives to those toxic substances?
Yes. The prompting by the European Union to remove these substances has forced the engineers to come up with alternatives. And the funny thing is, they have.
Well, who's got the bigger market, the United States or the European Union?
Well, that's the key thing to understand in this whole dynamic, is because it's the European Union. The European Union now is a much larger single market than the United States. And that's been at the core of this enormous political and economic shift.
So if the European lobby wants something banned, then manufacturers around the world better pay heed, because they're a huge market, even bigger than us.
Exactly, exactly. I mean, it used to be that the United States was the world's biggest market by far. And so when we passed a law, for example, we passed our environmental protection laws back in the 70s and 80s, the rest of the world pretty much followed what we were doing because they wanted to retain access to the American market. And now that's flipped, and it flipped specifically in 2005 when the European Union at that time expanded to 25 different countries, spreading, you know, from Portugal in the west all the way to Lithuania and Latvia in the east and Cyprus in the south and Finland up to the north. And so that's almost 500 million people, which is significantly larger than our own market of about 350, 370 million Americans. And that That shift, which I think many Americans have not been aware of, is having enormous impact on essentially who's writing the rules of the global economy.
You know, in the United States, the business lobbies are very powerful and often stand in the way of regulation because they feel like it's going to make producing their products too expensive and the regulations will be cumbersome. Doesn't Europe have business lobbies? I mean, how come the business lobby is so often successful in the United States when it comes to regulations, but in the European Union, these regulations are going through?
Well, that is a really good question, and it's a question I asked myself repeatedly as I went through this the reporting on this book, because the fact is that the Europeans are hardly some idyllic place where everything is resolved and everybody's in love with nature and we're all trying to find some harmony with the universe. There's a very powerful European industry lobby. It's extremely strong, extremely even intrusive in the legislative process. But there are some very key differences between the United States and Europe and in terms of the relationship of government to industry. And one of those differences is the role of campaign contributions, which you cannot do in Europe, and you can, of course, in the United States, which gives industry a lot more power in the U.S. And two, even more significantly, I think, is this critical thing. In Europe, the government pays for health care. You know, and when I realized this, I suddenly understood, and I began to look at things very differently. And it's basically the European governments pay for health care. And so they are basically looking down the line. They're looking 5, 10, 15, 20 years down the line at the illnesses that are caused by chemical exposure. And who pays for the cost of those illnesses? Well, the government does. And so the government is looking at tens and tens and tens of billions of dollars, as we here in the United States are. We're looking at the same kind of health effects from chemicals. But in the United States, it's we individuals that pay that cost. And in the European Union, it's the government that pays that cost. So that gives a very powerful incentive for European governments to act on these chemical contributors to health problems.
My guest is Mark Shapiro. His new book is called Exposed. We'll talk more about toxic chemicals and everyday products after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Mark Shapiro. He's the author of the book Exposed, The Toxic Chemistry of Everyday Products and What's at Stake for American Power. He's also the editorial director of the Center for Investigative Reporting in Berkeley. Let me move on to genetically modified organisms, GMOs as they're called, and that would include corn. And in the United States, there's a lot of genetically modified corn being grown. But the European Union has outlawed genetically modified organisms, right?
Well, it's a little more complicated than that, because what the Europeans have done is they have not banned the sale of genetically modified food in Europe. What they've done is imposed strict scientific requirements, and each new variety of genetically modified corn, whether it's corn or wheat or other types of commodities, has to be analyzed by a scientific body that actually assesses, number one, what its nutritional impact is, and number two, what its long-term effects are on the environmental balance of agriculture, basically. And if it passes this very strenuous series of assessments, then it can get onto the European market and can be sold in Europe. But what's happened, number one, is there's a very limited number of varieties that have been accepted for sale in Europe. And two, the European consumers have time after time after time expressed no desire for genetically modified ingredients in their food. So basically what's happened is that there's no market for genetically engineered food, whereas here in the United States, which we kind of jumped into this technology without really assessing what its potential risks were, there are basically no controls over genetically engineered food. We treat it like any other crop, basically.
And we consumers don't know whether the corn in our products is genetically modified or not.
Right. Right. You have no idea because there's no labeling requirement here. And there is a labeling requirement in Europe. And the food processors know that if they have a genetically modified food ingredient label on a can or a box of goods, it's not going to sell. So as a result, there's no market.
I could see a lot of manufacturers thinking that the European Union model is such a bureaucratic maze that it would be hard to operate within it. And I'm wondering, from your research into the EU model of regulation, how much of a bureaucratic maze is it? You know, all this regulation must be kind of difficult to navigate.
I think there are multiple elements to that. One, I think many Americans like to think that the EU is this kind of confusing bundle of different countries and all these languages and these funny regulations over the size of the funny things. The size of salami has to be uniform, and the crazy multiple languages that they're operating in. But in fact, what they've missed during this whole evolution of the EU is the emergence of a very powerful governing force. And that government force works very much like our own governing force. When they come out with a regulation, the news is sent out from Brussels to all the member states of the European Union, and those member states are obligated to establish those new rules. So here in the United States, I think what you're onto, Terry, is this idea that basically the argument against regulation in the United States is that it impinges on innovation. And that we here in the United States take great pride in the innovation of our business and the ability, the relative freedom that we have to come up with new ideas and new approaches. Well, to some extent, that's true. But when you're talking about questions of environmental damage and such like that, the other part of that equation is the incredible innovation that could be prompted by establishing governmental rules as to what is and is not acceptable. So essentially what the Europeans have done is establish a new floor by which their industry operates. They say these particular chemicals are too dangerous to be accepted in consumer products across the board. Start from there and then move up and compete. And so there's enormous competition now in the European Union over coming up with new approaches, new products, less toxic ingredients. Competition has not been stopped. It's just been moved to a higher level.
Summarize for us, if you would, how you think the United States is gaining and or losing from the European Union's regulations of toxics.
Here's what I think is really a powerful thing that I learned even in the process of doing the reporting, is that the United States, in its intransigence when it comes to environmental protection, is actually losing ground globally. So when I talk about these various initiatives that are coming out of Europe now on environmental protection, those initiatives are not limited to Europe. They're actually traveling across the world. So, for example, the emerging economies, India, Brazil, Taiwan, places like that, they have begun sending delegations regularly to Brussels to learn how they regulate cosmetics, because there's a growing movement in their countries to protect citizens from hazards in cosmetics. So the same thing in industrial chemicals and in chemicals and electronics. In electronics, the Chinese, who manufacture a lot of the electrical goods, are beginning to establish rules very close to those of the European Union. The Chinese have banned the same list of substances in electronics used for their own people that the Europeans have. And you know what they've done is they've, of course, exempted exports. So we'll be the ones receiving the electronics with chemicals that are banned in the European Union and starting early next year in China. So what's on the negative side of what you're talking about in terms of what the U.S. is losing? We're losing an enormous amount of global influence. Number two, when American multinational companies begin to adapt their production lines to those requirements of the European Union, like I talked about with the electronics industry and even with the some of the cosmetic companies and other companies, when they begin adapting to the European laws, what does that mean here in the United States? It means that our own regulatory authorities, the FDA and the EPA and others, have become irrelevant to the decisions of major American industries. And third is the effect on our competitive position. So what are people going to think over time? When, as you have emerging middle class in emerging economies all around the world, and globalization begins to take even more hold than it has today. Well, when people are given a choice between products that have gone through a toxic screen in the European Union and have not gone through a toxic screen in the United States, which ones are they going to choose? So I think there's enormous economic implications for these changes as well.
How has your investigation into toxics in everyday products affected the products that you use?
That's a very good question. I suppose I'm more understanding of the ways that my body sort of interacts and the metabolism interacts with chemicals. I'm not a kind of a natural kind of organic obsessive person, so I'm not, to be honest, totally neurotic about these questions. What really gets me is I like to have the information. What really gets me most is not having the information and knowing that the industry and the government have gone through extraordinary lengths to prevent me and you and everybody else from having the information about these kind of substances so you can make a choice. And I think at the very minimum, that is something that people can demand here. How has it changed the way I do things? I suppose let's face it, I've always been kind of skeptical of what I don't know. When I don't know something, I assume there might be something dicey happening. So I assume that...
you're killing yourself.
I kind of assume. Thank you. Or, you know, I could be really totally honest. I mean, I smoke. I mean, I enjoy smoking, and I like having a cigarette every once in a while. And sometimes more than every once in a while. Just I like to have a cigarette. But I know exactly what I'm doing. I light up a cigarette. I know what I'm doing. I know the risks. I know what it is. I'm of course totally aware of what's involved with a cigarette. So and I think the thing that gets me about this whole issue is really what you don't know. Get the information out there, and then people can make a decision as to the risks that you want to take. And right now, that information isn't out there.
At the beginning of our conversation, you mentioned these phthalates, this toxic substance that's in a lot of soft plastics, including a lot of children's toys and baby toys. So for parents who want to make sure that they're not buying toys that have phthalates in them, is there any way of knowing?
There are some toys that are coming out now that say phthalate-free, and one can only presume that those manufacturers are telling the truth. And because there's no government out there affirming that that's the case, it's highly unclear that that's exactly the case. But let's presume that they're telling the truth. And the other way they could do it, they can fly to the state of California starting in January 2009 and buy their toys in the state of California. Or they could, of course, fly to Brussels or to anywhere in Europe right now and buy their toys there.
That sounds really efficient.
It's a nice excuse to go to Europe.
Yes. Okay. Well, thanks for all the bad news.
Listen. I want to make it clear that I don't see this book as a bad news book. What I think is actually really interesting is that in the U.S., I've been following like environmental topics for years, you know, for like two decades I've been writing about environmental topics. And I've found these arguments over and over and over again. You know, environmentalists say, take this stuff out, it's really dangerous. And the industry is coming back and saying, you know, get real. We've got to make trade-offs in modern society. You're going to end up with throwing a lot of people out of work, and it's going to get more expensive, and it would be an economic catastrophe for our country. And plus, the stuff isn't dangerous anyway. And I got, to be honest, I get kind of tired of that dynamic. It gets kind of like kabuki theater after a while. You know, the same kind of arguments back and forth. It's all kabuki. And so then I started following what was happening in Europe. And I said, hey, wait a minute. Hold on here for a second. The world's major economy is actually requiring that things be done differently. And so what's the reaction here in the United States? And so I started looking at what was the effect in Europe when this started happening. And the effect is down the line, all these industries we've been talking about and more, the economic catastrophe that was predicted never happened. It never happened. So this has been a bluff over and over and over and over here in the United States, a bluff as to what is and isn't possible. So I see it as the opposite, as a kind of bummer. I actually see it as kind of a new way of looking at things and a new way of suggesting, you know, what's possible, really.
Well, in that case, thanks for the good news.
Okay, good. Glad to hear it that way.
Mark Shapiro, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Mark Shapiro is the author of Exposed, The Toxic Chemistry of Everyday Products and What's at Stake for American Power. He's the editorial director of the Center for Investigative Reporting in Berkeley. By the way, tomorrow we'll talk about rethinking how we use and conserve water. Coming up, our book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews a new novella set at a Red Lobster restaurant. This is Fresh Air. Although writer Stuart Onan has nearly 20 works of fiction and nonfiction to his credit, his name isn't that well known beyond the community of loyal readers and independent bookstore prowlers. But book critic Maureen Corrigan predicts that Onan's literary celebrity will grow in the wake of his latest book, Last Night at the Lobster, a little book that's making a big splash. Here's her review.
Novella is one of those lightly pretentious literary terms that just oozes class, poetic language, and eternal themes. Thomas Mann's Death in Venice set the gold standard for this category, packing a story about illicit love and, yes, death, festooned with allusions to classical Greek mythology into a scant 100 or so pages. You wouldn't ordinarily think of the term novella in connection with deep fat fryers and frozen tilapia, but fortunately for us readers, Stuart Onan did. His newly published novella, called Last Night at the Lobster, is a shimmering story about the centrality of work, even drudge work, in people's lives. It's also about the unruly alternative families that the workplace creates. As in Mann's classic, the big themes of love and loss pervade Onan's novella, although here they come garnished not with mythological allusions, but with tartar sauce. That's because Onan's story is set in a Red Lobster restaurant on the day before it's scheduled to shut down on orders from corporate headquarters. The main character of Onan's tale is Manny DeLeon, the 35-year-old manager of this doomed Red Lobster that sits in a corner of a rundown Connecticut shopping mall. Manny is a decent guy, though he's screwed up by having an affair with one of his current employees, a sexy waitress named Jackie. Manny's girlfriend, Dina, is now pregnant, and he and Jackie are history, though he still yearns for Jackie, and this being closing day, he'll never see her again after tonight. When Manny arrives to open the lobster for the final time, 4 shopping days before Christmas, a snowstorm is gathering force, and he's now down from 44 employees to a skeleton staff of about 10. That's if everybody shows up. After Christmas, 4 of those workers, survivors whom Manny selected, will go with him over to the Olive Garden in another nearby mall. Manny fortifies himself against the stress of the coming hours by smoking a joint in his parked Buick, and Onan, who writes in the tension-building present tense, neatly describes Manny as he bends to a flame, then nods back astronaut-like against the headrest and exhales. An hour or so later, after he's checked the temperature of the walk-in refrigerator, spray-cleaned the gummy shellac tables, and dumped a bucket of old cooking oil from the fryolator, Manny will realize that he's no longer stoned, that private part of the day is over. One more last thing. That's one aspect of work among many that Onan really nails here, the mutinous impulse to carve out small spaces of private time during the shift. Some of the workers arrive, the day kicks into gear, and despite the snow falling more heavily now, the usual assortment of regulars and mall rats shows up. Among them, a noisy office retirement party, an oblivious young mother with her demon child of a son, and a pair of elderly women, cottonheads, as they're dismissively called, who wave around an expired meal coupon and drive the waitress nuts. Here's how Onan describes that situation. The grandmothers insist the coupon's barely expired. The waitress hands it to Manny as if it's dipped in anthrax. The expiration date is last Saturday, close enough, except as he's standing there, he notices the ceramic holder that should be full of Sugar and Equal and Splenda and Sweet and Low packets has been picked clean. Always a danger with these cotton heads, their memories of the Depression pushing them beyond thrift into greed. It shouldn't matter to him, since anything not in a sealed box will probably get tossed, but now he feels doubly fooled. The cottonheads don't get their freebie, and so leave a penny tip. The creepy kid pukes up butterscotch ice cream sundae all over the main dining room rug, and on it goes into the snowy night. Manny, like the captain of a foundering tanker, struggles mightily to steer his restaurant into port for the final time, all the while dreading the moment when he has to say goodbye both to Jackie and to a job that's defined him for years. In restrained, beautifully detailed, and often hilarious fashion, Last Night at the Lobster evokes a sense of loss, both mundane and transcendent. When Manny locks the door on the Lobster, that clean, well-lighted place at the corner of a dark and snowy mall parking lot, you feel like something more than the shrimp scampi special has been sold out.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Last Night at the Lobster by Stuart Onan. You can download podcasts of our show by going to our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble and the Barnes & Noble Review, the new online literary magazine with reviews, interviews, and recommendations. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world, at macfound.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, rethinking how we use and conserve water, including what we drink and how we flush our toilets. We talk with Peter Glick, a MacArthur Fellow, editor of the biennial report, The World's Water, and co-founder of the Pacific Institute. Join us for the next Fresh Air.